Today is Wednesday, September 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. House of Representatives begins moving forward on an impeachment inquiry of President Trump.
The actions taken to date by the president have seriously violated the Constitution.
Also ahead, the latest from the United Nations, where President Trump meets with the Ukrainian president. And a look ahead as Hong Kong's chief executive prepares to meet with community members. Those stories and more are all coming up next. U.S. President Donald Trump asked Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to investigate if Democratic presidential contender and former Vice President Joe Biden shut down a probe into a Ukrainian company that employed his son, according to a summary memo of a July telephone call between the two leaders. It's important to note that the document is not a verbatim transcript of that phone call. Democrats have accused Trump, who is seeking re-election next year, of seeking Zelensky's help to hurt Biden's chances of winning the Democratic presidential nomination. The summary's disclosure comes one day after Democratic Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi announced a formal impeachment inquiry into Trump and allegations that he sought a foreign government's help with his 2020 re-election bid.
The actions taken to date by the president have seriously violated the Constitution, especially when the president says, Article 2 says I can do whatever I want. For the past several months, we have been investigating in our committees and litigating in the courts so the House can gather all the relevant facts and consider whether to exercise its full Article 1 powers, including a constitutional power of the utmost gravity, approval of articles of impeachment.
Pelosi accused Trump of betraying his oath of office, U.S. national security, and the security of U.S. elections. Joining us now is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So there has been a flurry of activity up on the Hill. What can you give us in terms of the latest reaction, both on the Democratic side after reading the memo and the Republicans?
Right. So this memo came out this morning just after House Democrats had their weekly caucus meeting, which, as you can imagine, was quite a caucus meeting after that announcement from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi last night formalizing the impeachment inquiry. A lot of what they had to say was that the memo proved what their concerns were when this impeachment inquiry was formalized, is that there was a quid pro quo between President Trump and the Ukrainian president, and that this represents a true national security threat. What really struck me in speaking to House Democrats is that they had a sense of urgency that I haven't heard up here on Capitol Hill before through all of the things that we've been through, the Mueller investigation, the Cohen testimony, all of these moments that we thought would be make or break for the Trump presidency that really weren't. Things are somehow different up here. Now, of course, House Republicans are seeing that differently and came out immediately and said that the memo proved that there was nothing to see here, a lot of smoke, no fire.
Now, this, of course, is coming after several requests of this whistleblower report that the Director of National Intelligence hasn't forwarded, as Pelosi said, must relay to the national, the relevant intelligence committees. But Acting DNI McGuire is scheduled to appear tomorrow. What can we expect to see from that, and what do House Democrats want to see?
Well, they certainly want to hear more about the actual whistleblower complaint. As they're correctly noting, we're kind of talking about two different things up here on Capitol Hill right now. We're talking about the memo of that Trump call, and then we haven't even seen the whistleblower complaint, which could potentially hold even more information beyond that phone call. That's going to be yet another turning point in really what has been an already extraordinary week up here on Capitol Hill.
Now, this, of course, is all taking place in the House. The impeachment inquiry is the first step. But to actually impeach the president, you need to get, more than just the majority in the House. Where do the House Democrats see, the total number of votes coming if an impeachment vote were to take place today?
Right. So that number has been going up rapidly just in the last 24 hours. We saw a flood of Democrats coming out making statements in the past 24 to 36 hours in support of an impeachment inquiry. Right now, that number stands at about 212 out of the 218 House Democrats. Now, all the formalization of the impeachment inquiry does is kind of formalize and gather together all of the investigations that were already underway. What happens next is that those investigations then get referred to the House Judiciary Committee, which would then be the referring committee to bring that to a House floor vote for an actual impeachment vote. So I know that sounds like a lot of steps, but in speaking to House Democrats today, there was a real urgency and a sense that they need to complete this quickly, and they probably need to complete it before the end of the year.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
In New York, at the United Nations, the General Assembly continues a day after U.S. President Donald Trump called Iran one of the world's greatest threats.
All nations have a duty to act. No responsible government should subsidize Iran's bloodlust. As long as Iran's menacing behavior continues, sanctions will not be lifted. They will be tightened. Iran's leaders will have turned a proud nation into just another cautionary tale of what happens when a ruling class abandons its people and embarks on a crusade for personal power and riches.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani took to the podium today and gave his rebuttal. And now joining us on the phone from New York is VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank you.
So what can you tell us about Rouhani's presentation today at the UNGA?
Well, he had a different take than President Trump, that's for sure. He said no talk till sanctions are lifted. That was his bottom line. There was a lot of talk in the week before the attacks in Saudi Arabia that the U.S. and Iran might meet while they were here in New York. But attacks in Saudi Arabia have affected that, obviously, and it became impossible for the two leaders to meet.
There's been a lot of speculation. Go ahead.
President Rouhani, in his speech, sort of mocked President Trump's love of a photo op, because we've seen that quite a bit with the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, all the pageantry and the flags and the photos. And Rouhani said that memorial photos are the last stage of negotiations, not the first one. So that was sort of his way of saying there'll be no photo ops.
Well, the other big item today on the president's itinerary is his bilateral meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. That's scheduled to take place at 2:15 later today. What can you tell us about the buzz around that meeting, given the memo's release and all the impeachment talk here in Washington?
Well, yeah, it's just here in New York. And I mean, it's sort of awkward timing since this, everything is breaking today. And I think a lot of countries are sort of sympathetic to Ukraine's position in all of this because they understand what it is to be dependent on the United States for either humanitarian aid or military aid. And you don't really want to get caught up or embroiled in some sort of domestic scandal with the United States when you're dependent on them. So I think, and especially President Zelensky, he's not a politician. He was an actor, a comedian in his previous life. So he's not a seasoned politician who knows how to roll with these sort of things. And he's meeting the president of the United States. So I think there's a bit of sympathy from other leaders here for him. It's not an enviable position to be in. But I don't know that really people are paying attention to the transcript here. You know, there's so much going on here. There's 630 events going on here this week. So I think people are very intensely focused on their own business that they've come here to do. But this is sort of buzzing around them.
And really quickly, in about 15, 20 seconds, what else should our listeners be aware of what's taking place today?
Lots more speeches. And there's some meetings on Africa this week. Today, we have a meeting on Mali and Sahel. That's an anticipated high-level meeting in the Security Council today on regional organizations. So more things about regional and sub-regional cooperation today.
Margaret Bashir reports for VOA from New York at the United Nations. Thank you so much for your insights.
Thanks for having me on.
Order. Colleagues, welcome back to our place of work. The UK Supreme Court ruled yesterday that Parliament has not been prorogued and that the Speaker of the House of Commons and the Lord Speaker can take immediate steps to enable each House to meet as soon as possible to decide upon a way forward.
That was House of Commons Speaker John Bercow speaking as Britain's Parliament resumed sitting a day after the Supreme Court ruled that the Prime Minister's suspension of Parliament was unlawful. The verdict given on Tuesday means the government's attempt to prorogue or suspend Parliament never took effect. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's top legal adviser, Attorney General Geoffrey Cox, said the government would comply with a law passed by Parliament to force the British leader to request a delay to Brexit if no agreement with the European Union is in place by October 19th. And this is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
We recently reported on the discovery of the second known interstellar visitor to our solar system. The object, initially dubbed C2019Q4, was discovered by Gennady Borisov on August 30, 2019, with a 0.6-meter telescope he built himself. Since its discovery, astronomers around the world have been observing what appears to be a comet. They have computed its orbit and have determined that it is indeed of interstellar origin. The International Astronomical Union, an organization recognized as the authority for naming celestial bodies, has given the object an official name, 2I Borisov. While the comet is heading toward the sun, astronomers say it will only make it to a point that's a bit beyond the orbit of Mars before its trajectory takes it out of the solar system and returns to interstellar space. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Dozens of Hong Kong anti-government protesters appeared in court on Wednesday charged with rioting and other offenses over violent clashes 2 months ago near China's main representative office. The protesters are furious at what they see as creeping Chinese interference in Hong Kong, which returned to Beijing's control in 1997 under a one-country, two-systems formula intended to guarantee freedoms that are not enjoyed on the mainland. China says it is committed to the arrangement and denies meddling and has accused foreign governments, including the United States and Britain, of inciting unrest. Thursday evening local time, Chief Executive Carrie Lam will meet with about 150 citizens and invite them to share their views. It's the first formal talks after months of protests. Joining us now on the phone is Roger Baker, Stratfor Senior Vice President of Strategic Analysis, to give us a preview. Roger, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So we have this meeting tomorrow with 150 citizens and Carrie Lam. What can we expect?
Well, I'm not sure that we can expect a whole lot out of this. This is supposed to be this initial piece of her four-part promise. This is the second part, having a direct dialogue with the community. At the moment, it's supposed to be a listening dialogue, but from what we understand, most of the active protesters refuse to even sign up to be potentially chosen for the dialogue. So it looks like this is an opportunity for her to at least show that she's listening to some people, other government officials to be there, and then maybe to make some comments about how to ease tensions, maybe look at things like housing or jobs down the road.
Now, some critics have said this is nothing more than just a political stunt, a political show. Is she really going to listen, or is this really just a way to kind of meet with community members to hopefully quell the violent protests?
Well, I think a lot of it is the latter. It's a way to show that she's taking steps, and it's a way to ease both the pressure that she's getting inside Hong Kong and potentially the pressure that she's receiving from China to bring some order back to Hong Kong.
Now, the protesters are saying that they want five demands, not one less. They've already gotten Carrie Lam to formally withdraw the extradition bill, which launched all the protests. But they've asked, you know, for better representation, investigation into allegations of police misdoing, retraction of the word riot to describe the rallies and releasing of all the demonstrators. How likely is it that Carrie Lam can and actually will move on those kinds of demands?
I think there's a potential for an independent or semi-independent police commission. That would be a relatively easy one. If they could get the protesters to back down, there's the possibility of some form of partial amnesty, partially maybe even changing and saying, okay, some of them weren't rioters. I don't think it's going to be 100% across the board. But the place where I don't think that she has really any room to back down is on their final demand, which is dual universal suffrage. And that's something that just doesn't seem to be likely in the works for Hong Kong.
We have about a minute left. One of the things I wanted to ask you is that as we take a look at these protests, we've seen the clashes continue, the use of water cannons, rubber bullets, tear gas. What do you think would be Beijing's tipping point to take a more forceful stance in quelling the protests, given the length that they've gone on so far?
I think it would require a couple of things. One would be the inability of Hong Kong police to manage a situation during one of these big weekend riots. In other words, if it continues at a high level of violence and it's clear that the Hong Kong police lines are either broken or that the Hong Kong police start shifting their allegiance and working with the protesters. And the other would be that if these protests start to take serious action against core Chinese interests within that space, those would be the immediate things. The final thing would be if the Hong Kong government just decides they can't manage this anymore and they declare an emergency ordinance.
Roger Baker is Senior Vice President for Stratfor on their strategic analysis. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
U.S. forces said Wednesday that they had killed 11 suspected militants linked to Islamic State in their second airstrike near the southern Libyan town of Mukzouk in less than a week. The attack carried out on Tuesday followed a September 19th strike that the U.S. said had killed 8 suspected militants. Some Islamic State militants retreated south to Libya's desert as the group lost its stronghold in the coastal city of Sirte at the end of 2016. The U.S. has said it will not allow militants to use a conflict between Eastern and Western-based factions around the capital of Tripoli to protect themselves. Eastern-based forces led by Khalifa Haftar launched an offensive to capture Tripoli in April, upending UN-led plans to broker a political settlement in Libya. The Universal Postal Union warns of a major disruption to the global postal system and huge price hikes for consumers if the United States withdraws from the UN organization. These are Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the UPU held an extraordinary Congress to prevent this from happening.
The Trump administration's threat to withdraw from the UPU has triggered this extraordinary Congress. Washington is angry that China, considered a developing country, pays lower postal rates than the U.S. UPU Secretary General Bishar Hussein says the meeting seeks to find a compromise solution to keep the U.S. within the Universal Postal Union.
The U.S. is a very major player of the union. The economy is very big, and many countries have a huge traffic postal and packets traffic with the United States. So a departure of the United States from the union would mean then it's a total disruption of the service of that country. Because the moment a country leaves the treaty, what happens is that that country does not exist for us in our global postal territory.
Three different proposals are on the table. The United States favors option B, which would allow countries to immediately self-declare their own rates. Assistant to the President and Director of the Office of Trade and Manufacturing Policy, Peter Navarro, heads the U.S. delegation. He agrees this option might cause some very short-term disruptions, but he says it is the fairest and quickest path to a reform that is long overdue. Hussein says he prefers another more balanced proposal that allows nations to set their own postal rates at a slower pace. He tells VOA there will be negative consequences for the U.S. if it leaves the Union. He warns it will not be cost-free.
The moment a country walks away from a treaty, the Universal Postal Union, all the services and all the standards and the rules that govern the international mail supply chain system we have developed over the 145 years will no longer be accessible to them.
He says a country that leaves the treaty will no longer be able to exchange any letters, packets, or parcels using the Union's postal code and system. Hussein says the United States will have to negotiate different bilateral agreements with 192 countries. He says countries may have to use other channels to deliver the mail to the United States at higher rates. He adds it is the consumer who will have to pay. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Israel's president on Wednesday summoned the leaders of the country's two largest parties to his residence for a second time in a stepped-up effort to break the post-election political deadlock paralyzing the nation. President Reuven Rivlin is responsible for choosing the candidate he believes has the best chance of forming a coalition government, but neither Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu nor his challenger Benny Gantz won the required support of parliamentary majority in last week's election. A rare painting by the 13th century Italian master Cimabue was found in an elderly French woman's home northeast of Paris. As VOA's David Byrd reports, auctioneers expect it to fetch millions at an auction next month.
The painting, entitled Christ Mocked, depicts Jesus surrounded by hostile crowds prior to his crucifixion. It's painted on a poplar wood panel with a background of gold paint and measures about 24 by 20 centimeters. Art expert Stéphane Pantin of the Turquin Gallery in Paris says the painting offers historians a missing piece in the puzzle that is art history.
This is a major discovery for the history of art. I often say art history is a huge puzzle. It lacks some pieces, and we found a piece with this painting. This piece fits perfectly in the puzzle we're trying to complete. We're talking about the start of Western painting. This painting was painted between 1270 and 1280 when Notre Dame was not even built.
A family in Compiègne, France, owned the painting, which was hanging above a hot plate between the dining room and the kitchen of their home. Stéphane Pantin says that an auctioneer discovered the work while doing an inventory of the house.
This little painting was hanging on the wall that separated the dining room and the kitchen. When Maître Wolfe questioned the owner, he said it was a small icon he'd had for a very long time, and it's not important.
However, once appraisers checked the painting's origin, its worth became clear. Tests using infrared light determined the artwork's provenance. It was from the 13th century and was a genuine Cimabue. The painting goes on sale October 27th, and Stéphane Pantin of the Turquin Gallery says it could sell for as much as 6 million euros.
Alors, aucun tableau de Cimabue n'est jamais passé en vente. Jamais.
No painting of Cimabue was ever for sale. The National Gallery of London in 2000 was scheduled to sell a painting, but it was withdrawn to be the subject of a private transaction. This artist is so important for the history of art, so this is the first time the painting will go to auction. We gave an estimate between 4 and 6 million euros, but who knows what a painting of Cimabue is worth.
Experts think the masterpiece is part of a polyptych that Cimabue painted around the end of the 13th century. Two other panels from the same work are on display at the Frick Collection in New York and the National Gallery in London. In Washington, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
And with that, that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our director-producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Justin Thwaite, and managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, thank you so much for listening. Now, you'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at our VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.